Hi, welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Rick Atkinson. He's the author of The British Are Coming, The War for America, Lexington to Princeton, 1775 to 1777. Rick Atkinson is the best-selling author of the Liberation Trilogy, An Army at Dawn, which is the winner of the Pulitzer Prize for History, The Day of Battle, and The Guns at Last Light. He's also written The Long Gray Line and several other books. His many other additional awards include a Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, the George Polk Award, and the Pritzker Military Library Literature Award. Rick, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Joe. Good to be here.
So, after your great success with the military history of World War II, what made you decide to tackle the American Revolution for your next project?
Well, the obvious thing would have been to turn to the Pacific, having finished in the Mediterranean and Western Europe. But that, among other things, would have required me to start the war over again. I'd ended it May 8, 1945, with the surrender of Germany in World War II. And I just didn't have the heart for that, for one thing, to start over at Pearl Harbor or whatever. And after 15 years, I was ready to try something else. And casting about, I've always, since I was a kid, had an interest in the American Revolution, answering questions about who we are, where we came from, what we believe, what our ancestors were willing to die for, the most profound question any people can ask themselves. And so I decided that I would go back two centuries into a much different war and deal with the revolution. And the reason that it will be a trilogy is in part because that's just the way the story seems to break. I don't think that a trilogy is the necessary form that every narrative history has to take, but this one falls neatly into that kind of format.
One of the, you know, kind of beginning myths about the start of the revolution, we often think about Lexington and Concord as kind of one event, but you show how they're really different in nature. You say Lexington was a battle, not a battle, but an execution. So can you tell a little bit about the difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it's essentially a meeting engagement at Lexington. You've got a rabble of militiamen who've turned out in the cold, and the British are not coming. They are dismissed, and some of them go to a tavern, and some of them go home. Many of them don't come back when they're summoned back when the British actually are approaching Lexington. And it's not clear who fired the first shot. We will never know that for certain, but it is an execution. There are eight Americans who are killed there on the green. They let off a rather ragged volley. They do no damage to the British. They hit a horse twice, and there's an enlisted British soldier who's lightly wounded. And then they're off to Concord, which is a few miles down the road. And there, by that time, this is now mid-morning of April 19, 1775, the troops have rallied, and they're well-prepared, they're well-led, they have a plan. That's a real fight. The British have orders to find military cannons and other materiel. They find almost nothing because the Americans have been well-prepared, and they've moved the stuff. And so what you find at North Bridge, when the British are continuing their search, outside of Concord is an ambush. Americans are waiting for them. And at the bridge, the British take several volleys. There are two Americans killed there. There are several British killed, two tenants mortally wounded for the British. And that's the beginning of a long, brutal day for the British, because at that point, then they're going to be retreating to Boston. It's 19 miles. They're going to be ambushed at every turn. They're heavily outnumbered by the end of the day. They're probably 4,000 Americans lining what we now call Battle Road on the way back. Mm-hmm. And the only reason they're not obliterated is that a relief force has been sent out under General Percy. And at Lexington, very close to Lexington, he basically takes this retreating rabble of a British column under his wing and gives them protection back into Boston. It's a very long, bloody day for the British in particular, the Americans also. You know, it's the beginning of the revolution, obviously, but it's also the beginning of a sense that this is going to be really, really nasty. This is 18th century warfare in a pretty profound way.
Yeah, and the numbers are quite amazing. I mean, you mentioned 4,000 troops coming out to fight against the regulars. Put it into perspective, the city of Boston population is 15,000, I think, at the time.
Well, that's right, yeah.
So, I mean, it's a huge groundswell of support.
That's right, and they come from all over the countryside. There are several dozen villages that have sent militia companies. and they've rallied. They're pretty well prepared, and they have a good intelligence network. They know when the British are leaving Boston previous night. They know the route they're taking. They've been warned, obviously, by Paul Revere and William Dawes. But there are other intelligence sources that are quite accurate about the size of the British force, what they're up to, what they're aiming for. They know they're going to Concord. And so that allows them to be pretty well prepared by militia standards in 1775.
Right. Now, of course, when the British get back, I mean, the next major engagement is the Battle of Bunker Hill. Preceding that, you know, the actual battle, you have the British making the decision to burn the town of Charlestown. How does this plan fit in with the general British plans to treat civilians throughout the war?
Well, I think it backfires on them in a significant way. The British recognize that in counterinsurgency, winning hearts and minds, which is a phrase that General Clinton, British commander-in-chief, ultimately for 4 years in America, has coined. They know that in order to receive sustenance, literally sustenance, from the colonies and to try to tamp down this raging insurgency, that they've got to win over the locals. Well, you don't do that by burning down towns. Mm-hmm. And they start with Charlestown, and they move to Falmouth in what is now Maine. Norfolk is next. Part of Norfolk is burned by the British. The rest is burned by the rebels. And I think that what you see in Charlestown is tactical decision made on the spot, somewhat out of vengeance. There are snipers on the edge of Charlestown who are firing at the British as they're ascending Breed's Hill, firing from their flank. The British have taken heavy casualties already at this point, and they're going to get heavier. One out of every eight British officer who's killed in 8 years of war dies in 4 hours at Bunker Hill. And so when British Admiral on the scene asks General Howe, do you want me to fire on the town to try to tamp down the sniping that's gone on? He says, yes. Well, they use not only round shot, but also carcasses, which is a kind of incendiary device. Wooden town goes up in smoke instantly. It's a catastrophic loss of the town. But the bigger loss, I think, is to the British, because the Americans, among other things, are extremely good at turning events like that to their advantage. Their information ops in general are extraordinarily effective. And the word spreads throughout the colonies very quickly of what has happened and that the British are burning American towns. They're firing on women and children. And that is a... And that's a headline that's difficult to overcome when, in fact, your ambition is to win hearts and minds.
And that certainly doesn't help them, you know, get the sustenance that they were planning on from the local population.
Every time they venture out of Boston initially or New York later, they get ambushed. And it makes their job all the more difficult because they end up having to bring virtually all of their food and fodder from either ports in England or particularly Cork and the southern coast of Ireland. Oh, they send ships off to Canada looking for fodder for their horses, send expeditions to the West Indies looking for food and fodder. This is an ongoing, perpetual difficulty for the British that's going to last for the better part of 8 years.
And you mentioned like the number of livestock that they try to ship over versus how many actually arrive.
Well, when General Howe is in New York in the summer of 1776, after they've been forced out of Boston, he asks the war ministry for 950 horses, and they ship 950 horses. And shipping horses transatlantically in the age of sail across 3,000 miles of open ocean is very, very difficult, as it turns out. 450 of them die in transit. There are horse carcasses being hauled out of the holds and tossed overboard all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. Scores more of them arrive in such bad shape that they're useless. Many of them die after they've arrived. So that's just one example of the many difficult logistical issues facing the British. Expeditionary warfare is always hard. We know that in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and it's really hard in the age of sail in the 18th century.
Now, of course, the Americans are also facing huge supply problems. When Washington first comes to meet his new army, they don't even have enough powder to give him a salute.
Well, that's right. Yeah, Washington is astonished to find out how poorly provided he is with munitions in particular. He's not rich in anything, and munitions are especially a problem. And you see in his correspondence from the time he takes command of the Continental Army in July 1775 until the time the British are forced out in March of 1776, is constantly writing about gunpowder and saltpeter, which is the active ingredient in gunpowder. He's always fretful about his short supplies. There are recipes in local newspapers on how to make saltpeter. There's a lot of gun running going on, trying to bring, you know, a ton here and a ton there. And it's just one of the many shortages that the Americans have. Salt, for example. Can't move an army or a navy without salt meat. And you can't have salt meat without salt. And when the war begins, much of our salt has been coming from Britain and Europe. And there's an embargo, basically, and there's a very difficult period in which trying to get any salt at all into the country is hard. And again, there are recipes for how to make salt, and there are salt factories set up along the Jersey coast, and Virginia has tidal pools, and they're trying to make salt, and the cost is prohibitive. It takes a lot of firewood to burn off seawater to make salt from the ocean. So there are a lot of logistical problems that the Americans are facing as well.
Right. Now, in addition to logistical challenges, Americans are also facing some strategic challenges. I'm thinking particularly the decision to invade Canada. Can you go a little bit into that?
Yeah. I mean, a war that's ostensibly fought for basic rights and freedom immediately takes a turn in which the Americans turn into the aggressors and send an army into Canada, two prongs, one led by Benedict Arnold with about 1,100 men through the Maine wilderness, the Maine force going up Lake Champlain into Quebec. They're successful initially. Montreal is captured. The last British stronghold in all of Canada is the city of Quebec, the fortress. There's been an argument about whether this is a good idea, about whether, in fact, it betrays the notion that we're fighting for our freedoms and not for Canadian freedoms. There's also an argument that if you can seize Canada and make them a 14th colony, that that prevents the British from using it as a staging area for their own attack down the Champlain Corridor to New York, which is, of course, what they do in 1777. It's a debacle from the beginning. It's poorly conceived. It's poorly managed. It's poorly provisioned. You end up with the commander of the force in attacking Quebec, General Montgomery, former British Army officer, killed. Arnold is badly wounded, shot in the knee. It's the beginning of a long, painful retreat. Smallpox is besetting the force. There are thousands of American soldiers who die in Canada or shortly after the retreat out of Canada.
Now, in your descriptions of the Canadian campaign, you describe Arnold as maybe the best combat commander in the war. Now, another character is General Charles Lee, who probably in his own mind thinks he's the best combat commander. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about him?
Yeah, Charles Lee is a really interesting character, and he's fun to write about. He was a nightmare for Washington because he's a very difficult character. He'd been a British Army officer, resigned his commission as a lieutenant colonel, ends up emigrating to the U.S. He's very outspoken. He's very radical in his politics, actually, and he immediately becomes a favorite of radicals in Congress, especially. He's recognized as somebody who's got combat experience and has experience that very few American officers have. He does think that he is an extraordinarily gifted military officer, which he is not. He's also disloyal to Washington, ultimately. We see that he's quite useful to the cause early on. He's at the siege of Boston. He knows how to organize a besieging army. He knows about logistics. He knows about the importance of camp sanitation. He knows lots of things about being commanding a force. And Washington relies on him a lot, uses his advice and listens to him carefully. He is sent to South Carolina, and when the British fleet tries to take Charleston, essentially, and is repulsed severely at Sullivan's Island in one of the great defeats of the Royal Navy in the 18th century, Charles Lee is the commander on the spot. So he has his utility, but he's a fool. And we find that he ignores Washington's repeated requests, pleas, for Lee to bring his portion of the army, which is in Westchester County after the defeat in New York, to unify it with Washington's main army at this point west of the Delaware. Lee takes his time. He doesn't abide by Washington's repeated requests. I think there are 8 requests. And foolishly, in mid-December of 1776, he decides that he's going to find his own quarters one evening in the little village of Basking Ridge, New Jersey. A British cavalry patrol learns that he's there, swoops in on him, captures him. There are headlines and bells pealing in London because they think they have captured the best commander in the American army. Washington recognizes that this may be a blessing in disguise because Lee has been increasingly disloyal and increasingly antagonistic in private letters that he's been writing to members of Congress about perhaps it's time for Washington to be replaced and perhaps I would be the man to replace him. Suddenly he's in jail and he's going to be in jail for quite a while until he's eventually exchanged. It turns out to be a good thing in the long run.
Yeah, you mentioned the letters. There's one particularly touching one where Washington kind of comes across a letter that he doesn't know that he's not supposed to read.
That's right. One of Washington's aides, Joseph Reed, who's a Philadelphia lawyer, and he's Washington's closest confidant. Washington has confided in him in a way that he's not with anyone else. Lee has a correspondence with Reed behind Washington's back shortly before Lee's captured. And in one of these letters, Washington thinks it's official correspondence. He opens the letter. He learns, he's deeply hurt by it, really shocked. He learns that Reed has been betraying him and that Lee is in cahoots with Reed. The scales kind of fall from Washington's eyes at this point about Lee and his relationship with Reed is never the same again.
Given Washington's problems with Lee, that kind of started earlier in the campaigns when starting in the summer of 76, when Washington is being chased out of Long Island, out of Manhattan, and William Howe constantly has him on the run. Is there a point where Howe could have ended the war if he was more aggressive?
I think you could probably argue that Howe could have ended the war at several points. Howe never has him on the run. It's more like on the trot because Howe is very methodical. Now, he's got reasons for it. For example, after he wins a stellar battle in Long Island outside of Brooklyn in late August of 1776, and the Americans are thoroughly routed, Howe refuses to attack the fortified American positions around Brooklyn because he knows that in expeditionary warfare, when you have a soldier who's killed or badly wounded, trying to find a replacement is very, very difficult, really impossible. The British Army is not very big at the time, and they're even in the best of times, they're hard-pressed to find replacements to keep the ranks up to speed. And so Howe is really cautious, and on this particular occasion, he does not attack Washington in the dark of night. With a providential fog rolling over the East River, manages to evacuate his army without the loss of a man back to Manhattan. And that is the, one episode where it's possible the war could have ended. The American army was trapped up against the East River and they get away. And we see the same kind of plodding, methodical approach that Howe takes subsequently, the campaign that follows in Westchester County. It takes Lee weeks to move 20 miles. Partly because he's got a big ungainly army, partly because of the horse problem we talked about. And so Washington is entrenched at White Plains. When that battle occurs in late October, early November, it's a defeat for the Continentals. There's no doubt about it, but they just pull back. They're trading space for time. And we see this over and over again with the Howe not quite being able to trap and destroy the adversary's army. And they live to fight another day. And that really what it's all about for Washington at this point is living to fight another day.
And then, of course, ultimately in the book, it's culminating with the battles at Trenton and Princeton. Can you tell us why those victories were so important?
Well, partly because there had been virtually no victories before then. A couple little skirmishes that the Continental Army managed to win. But for the most part, this is a badly battered, repeatedly defeated army. The army under Washington's direct control is under 3,000 men at this point. It's a country of 2.5 million people, and he's only got 3,000 men. They're badly fed, badly housed, badly shod. Many of them are barefoot or have shoes that are not worth the name. And they have managed again to get away by the skin of their teeth across the Delaware River as the British Army is coming on from New York, chasing them down through Trenton. And Washington recognizes that desperate times require desperate measures. And his impulse is always aggressive. His impulse is to find a way to strike a blow for morale reasons, among others. He's got pretty good intelligence and his own intelligence officer. I mean, his own staff generally. He doesn't have a staff. He is the staff. I mean, he's deciding where to put latrine pits. But he realizes that the British Hessian army has overextended itself in New Jersey and that they've got these caserns, including a Hessian encampment at Trenton, and that it's vulnerable. It's vulnerable in the same way that Washington's army has been vulnerable earlier in the war, and decides that despite the bad weather, that it's worth a try. Now, the plan doesn't work because he's got a three-prong attack. Two of the prongs never get across the river. But the prong that he is personally leading does get across, attacks Trenton from the north, captures or kills virtually the entire garrison. It's a signal victory. And then what does he do? Well, Washington returns to the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware and doubles down. He decides that he's going to do it again, which is really quite unexpected and really daring. Trying to bait the British into attacking him in Trenton after he recrosses into New Jersey. And then when they do that, and they're hammered pretty thoroughly by entrenched Continentals, slipping away, slipping around the British left flank to Princeton, where there is a rear guard garrison, and destroys that garrison, and then gets away to winter quarters in North Jersey. And the consequence of these three victories, really, Trenton 1, Trenton 2, and Princeton, is a sense that all is not lost. We can hold our own against this adversary. We've got a commander who not only has got some tactical skill, but has luck on his side, you know, the characteristic that Napoleon most cherishes in his generals, and Washington is lucky. And it rouses the population in a way that is really important, I think, to sustaining the cause, sustaining the army, and puts wind in their sails for the subsequent campaign in 1777.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in addition to his tactical skills, you describe him as a political general without equal. So to kind of bring it back to full circle from where you were before, how would you compare Washington to Eisenhower?
I think they're very similar in that aspect. First of all, neither of them is particularly good field general. Neither of them see the battlefield spatially and temporally the way a great captain does, the way Napoleon does, Grant. Neither of them have the wherewithal to dominate an adversary the way a great captain does. Both of them, lived with both of them now for 20 years, both of them make repeated mistakes as tactical commanders and operational commanders. But having said that, their job is not to move battalions around on a map. Their ultimate job, particularly in Eisenhower's case, since he's got such a large force, is to be a political general. Franklin Roosevelt says the reason he has made Eisenhower commander-in-chief because he's the best politician among the generals. And Eisenhower does not take that as a slur. And the same thing could be said about Washington. He's very attentive to Congress. He's very attentive to the colonial governors. He's very attentive to committees of safety. A lot of his correspondence is, first of all, acknowledging civilian control of the military. It's a concept that he basically is inventing as he goes along. And it's also ensuring that he's got the political support needed to support his army and to keep his political masters on his side. Eisenhower is exactly the same way. Eisenhower recognizes that there are larger, in a democracy or in an emerging republic, in the case of the Continental Army, that there are large institutions that need to be accommodated because they are the bulwarks of your force and of your cause. And Washington, you know, he writes the textbook on this, essentially. What Eisenhower is going to do 150 years later, he may not know it, he may not be able to articulate it, but it derives directly from what Washington has established as a kind of template for a commander-in-chief and his relationship with his political betters and the larger relationship with the republic that is providing his force. So those two in particular are singular, I think, in American military history in that regard.
It's been such a pleasure to, you know, to read the book and to sit down and speak with you about it today, Rick. So thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Joe. Real pleasure to be here.
And to all our listeners, thanks for joining. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere the podcasts are found. And visit AUSA.org for more information. Keep it all locked here for Army Matters and for next week's episode with Soldier Today. Have a great Army Day.